turned the corner and blew through another double set of doors and was confronted with a truck dock and dumpster. Circling the dock and following the sound of the footsteps, I turned at the corner of the building at a dead run into the parking lot where hundreds of people were flowing toward their cars. Standing still and breathless, I scanned the area, trying to see if anybody was still running, but no one was. They all just looked like regular museum patrons heading home. It was at that moment I felt a hand on my shoulder and turned to find the Cheyenne Nation scanning the crowd along with me.
Somebody stole my painting?
Chapter 7. It was the real deal. Beverly nursed her head wound with a Colt pack in the boardroom. With the rest of the staff, the Park County Sheriff, Vic, and me as the medical technicians checked on her. The study was period perfect, with no pigmentation altered, and the style was consistent with Adams. She glanced up at me. I am so sorry.
Don't be silly. I'm just glad you're okay.
Vic shook her head. Who in the world would go to these kinds of lengths to get that stupid portion of a painting? Quite a few, I'm afraid. Having had enough, Beverly pushed the EMTs away. I'm fine, really. The young man in the blue jumpsuit wasn't deterred. I'm afraid you're going to have to come with us back to the hospital for overnight observation. She glanced up at him. What? Jack Farrow, one of the new breed of Wyoming sheriffs, was seated next to Beverly, a handsome kid with his hat pushed back and a strong dollop of dark hair across his forehead. He was an ex-rodeo roughstock hand and tough as rawhide. Routine with this type of injury. Besides, I'm sure they're going to want to x-ray your head.
And find nothing?
The young sheriff smiled as Mary got Beverly's coat and assisted her in putting it on as she stood. It's the social implications of the piece and the fact that the missing painting is a national icon. There are plenty of private collectors who would be happy to pick up that artist proof on the black market and then keep it hidden for their own enjoyment. I nodded. Count von Lehmann seemed interested in it, and was supposed to meet us down here, but he hasn't shown. Mary shook her head. No, I saw him leaving with an entourage. There was also a woman who was curious about the piece. Vic turned to look at me. What'd you do, send out a newsletter? Ignoring her, I continued. A Katrina Dijon. Mary and Beverly turned to each other, both of their faces blank. Never heard of her. Jack stood and watched the ladies go. I'll do some checking. Assisting Beverly in showing the medical staff out, Mary turned back. As to the Count, I wouldn't be too upset. He can be a little flaky. Farrow nodded. Roger that. I stood, and Vic and I walked to the main room of the research library in time to see Henry reappear in the doorway of the boardroom.
She would be all right.
I think so, just knocked around a bit. I turned back to him as the Park County Sheriff joined us. Anything? Pulling a piece of paper he must have purloined from the staff, he unfolded it, revealing a flake of muddy blue about the size of a fingernail.
This must be a piece of pigment from the painting. I found it on the floor.
Jack sighed. So whoever hit Beverly definitely took it.
I think it is safe to assume.
Vic studied the paint chip. Someone who knew the building? Maybe, but it's also possible that they heard me coming and just took the only other door that was available. Jack rested a hand on his sidearm, a big Kimber semi-automatic, and pulled his hat down. You didn't get a glimpse of them or anything?
Nope.
I hate it when something like this happens in my county. The young sheriff shook his head. A smash and grab. Oh, don't worry about it, Jack. It'll turn up. I nudged his shoulder. Hey, how come you weren't at this shindig? Too many old girlfriends at this thing. And I don't need that kind of drama in my life. He nodded and started off toward the stairs as we followed. How long are you folks in town? We head out tomorrow. I glanced back at Henry. Heading home by way of where?
Billings.
The bear nodded.
Montana girls basketball, 3-on-3 state championship.
Jack studied the two of us and then dropped his head.
Interesting.
We shook. Let me know if anything pops up.
Will do.
We watched him hurry off and entered the museum at large, where the hologram of Buffalo Bill continued to speak to the empty hall. Vic stopped and stared at the apparition. Maybe he did it.
Bill Cody?
The bear gave it some thought and then shook his head. Vic looked at him. What?
A couple of weeks after the Battle of the Greasy Grass, or the Little Bighorn, as the white populace called it.
And he cocked his head as the hologram attempted to interrupt.
Cody rejoined the 5th Cavalry, still wearing his red fireman's shirt
and velvet pants with jingle bells attached, which was ridiculed as being a preposterous outfit for a scout whose number one resource, by the way, was stealth. Anyway, Cody encountered a group of 7 Cheyenne warriors, at which point he shot a young tribesman, Heo Wei, in the leg. Both men fired at each other, and the young warrior was killed. Cody then walked over, scalped his opponent, and proclaimed, "The first scalp for Custer." What, he was a buddy of Custer's? As a matter of fact, yes. The Cheyenne Nation sighed. Anyway, Cody sent the scalp home, where his wife opened the package expecting a gift, and fainted dead away. Yuck! He immediately returned to the stages of the East, where he reenacted the battle. As the run continued, the duel became more fantastic. Cody would end the show by holding the bloody relic aloft to the admiring throngs.
I bet Philadelphia audiences love that. You should see a Flyers game sometime, she yawned. So what happened to the scalp?
It is here at the museum somewhere. Henry glanced up at the hologram, which for once wasn't talking. All is fair in love and show business. Dog had not eaten the room, but had made a sloppy mess when drinking from the toilet, which Vic reported on from behind the closed door.
Your dog had a water fight of epic scale in here.
Sorry, I'm going to take him for a walk. I found the leash in my duffel, snapped the link onto his collar, and let him out, making sure I had the key to the room in my pocket. I walked us down the steps, turned the corner at the bar, and was surprised to see Count von Lehmann entertaining a half-dozen revelers who obviously weren't quite ready to give up the night. Circling around the stairway, I exited the hotel room from the side entrance and walked to my right, noticing the missing newsstand and magazine shop that used to be there.
Need some air?
Katrina Dijon, the blonde from the auction, lowered her head and peered out the passenger window of a silver Mercedes sedan, gleaming in the partial moonlight of the velvety night.
Or just walking your grizzly bear.
Stopping, I turned, and Dog ambled over and stuck his head in her window. Putting his head back out, I apologized. Sorry. I left him in the room while we were at the auction, and I think he got lonely. She smiled.
Want a lift?
No, thank you. We'll just circle the block and then go back. I saw the Count was entertaining in the bar.
Yes, but I've heard all those stories before. How did it go with your painting?
It was stolen. She stared at me and slipped the car into park.
You're kidding.
I wish I was. While we were at the auction, someone forcibly took it from the conservation area in the basement.
Forcibly?
The conservator was hurt.
Badly?
No, I think just her pride.
But someone has your painting.
Well, it's not really mine.
You should talk to Philippe about this.
Why?
How can I put it? Especially to an officer of the law.
She opened the door and got out, came around, and, leaning on her car, continued the conversation.
People who have questionable works sometimes see the Count. He, has a somewhat malleable ethic concerning the ownership of art.
He's a fence.
Exactly, she smiled. He has a habit of going from A to D by accidentally discovering C while forgetting B altogether.
All right, now I have to ask, how did you two meet?
Nonconformist unofficial art.
Is that a major?
In Russia, yes.
She folded her arms, covering the skin that was exposed by her dress to the cool of night.
Terms that were applied to certain artists in the period from Stalin to Glasnost, when, if their works were deemed as being dissident, they were likely to be shipped off to mental asylums or gulags.
I've heard that.
These artists constituted small, very insular groups who specialized in more modern styles that the government did not approve of, so they had to sell their wares on the black market. Unfortunately, there was little money being paid until Philippe arrived on the scene in the 60s. She shook her head. He had all the charm of an unmade bed, but he could make his way around Kiev, Odessa, Moscow, and St. Petersburg with hardly any trouble at all. By the time I met him, he had a catalogue of more than 1,000 pieces of art.
How did he get the stuff out of Russia?
Any way he could. Stuffing them in the linings of his suitcases, down the legs of his trousers, and in the liners of his hats. Have you been to his home and story?
No.
It's amazing and horrifying all the same. I mean, if the art had been left in the Soviet Union, it would have most certainly been destroyed.
So
He sells it? A little at a time, and surprisingly back to Russians, oligarchs who are attempting to retrieve pieces from their national past.
And these people come to him with other works of art?
Yes. He knows the buyers. She turned and moved back toward the driver's side of her car and opened the door. Let's go to the hotel and we'll talk with him.
All right. Dog and I will meet you in the bar. Katrina met me at the entrance where we'd exited, her car parked at the curb.
Come on.
I followed as Dog took in the surroundings. A little more upper class, but a lot less comfortable when compared with our usual haunts back at the Red Pony. Count von Lehmann was still there, and the numbers of the faithful had diminished only a little, leaving him, Conrad Weston, four other couples, and a very large man who pocketed his cell phone and stood as we arrived.
I helped you?
Katrina motioned for the big guy to sit, but he ignored her and stepped between the count and us. Spotting the bulge in his suit jacket, I stopped, and Dog immediately growled.
Serge, don't be tiresome. Katrina stepped around him and sat next to the count.
He was massive, certainly clocking in at over 300 pounds, a powerlifter kind of gaunt as seed, and his accent was thick, although his voice was surprisingly high and fluttered through a very Rasputin-like beard.
Serge Bushirov?
Staring at me, his small eyes looking a little unsettled.
I know you?
Depends, I smiled. Are you armed? He smiled back.
Depends.
I think both Dog and I cocked our heads at that. This is an establishment licensed to serve alcohol, and firearms aren't permitted. He flexed his shoulders and chest, and I guessed his age to be somewhere around 40, 45.
Permitted and allowed are two different things, my friend.
We'll see after I call over to the bartender and he alerts my buddies over at the Park County Sheriff's Department. He spread his hands.
We have barely met, and you already call for the backup?
Katrina barked at the count.
Philippe, call off your eunuch.
After a moment, Lehmann smiled. Serge, sit down, or I'll put you on a leash like he does his dog. I shook my head. No, either the gun goes or he does. The bodyguard didn't move.
Serge, go.
He turned to look at the count, but then did as he said, and began to move toward us. But when Dog curled his lip, revealing some dagger-like ivories accompanied by a rumble that increased in his chest, Serge diverted to the other side, giving us the hard eye the entire way. Frankly, I was relieved, because if he'd tripped and fallen on us, he probably would have killed us. I sat, and Dog buried his head in Katrina's lap. Conrad ran a hand through his blonde locks.
I see he's friendly.
Overly. I glanced around. Actually, he's probably not supposed to be in here either, so Serge could have called it a draw. I stuck a hand out to the nearest couple who looked a little uncomfortable. Walt Longmire. They relaxed a bit, the bald man indicating his companion.
Nadia, my girlfriend. I'm Klavdiy Kropotkov. Nice to meet you.
I extended a hand to another couple.
Nice to meet you.
The tallish man, who was embellished with an extravagant mustache, nodded.
Patrick Monahan, and this is my wife, Beverly.
I looked at the rest of the people. Two blondes, a smaller man with thick glasses, and another man who looked as if he were ready to nod off at any instant. Giving a general wave, I smiled.
Hello, everyone.
The bald man leaned forward, cocking his head slightly and smiling his Van Dyke to the side.
Philippe tells us you are a sheriff?
I nodded. Absaroka County, here in Wyoming.
So you are a real cowboy?
Conrad laughed.
Define real.
Ignoring Weston, the bald man laughed, and he had perfect teeth.
You have the hat and gun, so you must be a real cowboy.
Not necessarily. There isn't a cowboy I know who wouldn't take a rope over a gun any day.
You can make a living with a rope?
Sure, you can hang people.
Conrad settled into his chair with a smug look. I also ignored Weston and continued.
A rope and a horse, yep.
But surely you can make a living with a gun also.
His friend leaned in and touched his arm.
Kiki.
He shrugged. Hey, we dropped our guns for now. Which is more important, the rope or the horse?
Well, you're talking to a rancher's son, so I'd say the horse.
You can work with a horse, and you can travel with one, and besides, they're good company. Conrad once again studied me.
And you can eat them?
I made a face just to let him know my feelings on the subject. There have been instances, but most cowboys I know would rather eat their boots than their horse. Kiki nodded.
Have you ever heard of the Tuva Cup, Sheriff? Tuva is a small province in Russia, Buddhist by nature, Turkic by language.
More Mongolian, then?
Exactly. But they have a national race every 5 years, and it is spectacular.
His companion Nadia touched his arm again, and he turned to look at her in annoyance.
What?
The plane, it leaves in an hour.
It is my plane, it leaves when I say it leaves.
Turning back to me, he continued.
In this fabulous race, they travel over 100 miles a day.
She touched his arm once more, and he lowered his head, speaking quietly yet distinctively.
Do not touch me again.
She very carefully pulled her hand away. He raised his head and sighed, looking around the table.
I am afraid that we must leave.
He stood and extended his hand to me.
It was wonderful meeting you, Sheriff.
He turned and clasped the Count's hand in both of his.
Philippe, it has been glorious, and do remember what I said about that business we discussed.
My pleasure, Kiki.
He turned to Conrad, as the young man made to follow him.
You will assist the Count in looking out for my interests?
Of course.
He looked disappointed, but then nodded and sat again. The remainder of the group stood and followed him out the door onto the main street, but Kravopuskov paused before letting it close and studied me for a moment before disappearing.
An interesting man.
The Count turned to look at me and then laughed.
You could say that.
I motioned to the bartender who'd been studiously ignoring us, probably in hopes that we'd get out of there. As he approached, he looked down at Dog but said nothing.
Can I help you, sir?
I gestured toward Katrina.
Vodka tonic?
I looked at Weston, but he shook his head. And you, sir? Got any Rainier?
Yes, sir.
He didn't look very happy about it, but headed back for the bar, as I turned to the dwindling party and Dog sat.
Someone stole your painting?
Boy, word travels fast in the art world. He leaned back in his chair, running his hands through his hair, which did nothing to straighten it, actually making it look even more like a small gray bonfire on top of his head. The local constabulary was present, so I made some inquiries. Katrina took her drink as the bartender returned.
I told him you might be able to assist him.
Because I know all the art thieves?
I sipped my beer, something like that. Conrad smiled and nodded toward Philippe.
How do you know he didn't steal it?
I shrugged, turning to look at the Count. He doesn't seem like the type. He might take advantage, but I don't think he'd take private property. The Count turned to Katrina.
You've been telling stories out of school, he sighed.
I am something of an opportunist, yes. He shrugged and reached out for his glass.
It was stolen from the conservation room in the museum.
It was. And the conservationist was hit over the head to do it. He seemed genuinely concerned. Is she all right? I studied him.
Yes.
Then it is either someone intimate with the museum or someone who is desperate.
I'm leaning toward desperation.
Why?
As the local sheriff said, it just has a kind of smash-and-grab feel to it. Well, then perhaps I will hear from them. He set his wine back down. Now, why would anybody be so desperate as to hurt someone over such a trivial thing? As a cursory Adams study, what would you place as its value?
So, its validity was confirmed?
It was. He thought about it.
Oh, perhaps a few thousand.
He looked at Dog and then me.
Doesn't seem worth it, does it?
No, but there is $1 million tucked away in a dead man's shoebox. He sat forward.
Oh, my. This is getting interesting.
Now, as I stated, I doubt the study itself is worth $1 million. So, where did the money come from? He lifted his glass of wine again and glanced at Katrina.
This individual had other resources?
Not that I'm aware of. Conrad's voice was flat.
This individual Was he killed? I'm still waiting to find out about that.
Count von Lehmann sat back in his chair.
So, your investigation has more to do with $1 million than it does the stolen study?
Overall, but I don't particularly care for people hitting people over the head and stealing things in my estate.
Conrad chortled and drummed his fingers on the table in indication that he was ready to leave.
Understandable, but who would do such a thing?
The bartender approached in a lingering fashion, perhaps in hopes that we'd take the hint.
Would anybody like anything else? If not, I'd be closing the bar.
The Count waved him away.
That's fine, my good man.
He felt around in his pockets and then glanced at Katrina.
I seem to have left my wallet in my other pants. Would you mind?
She raised an eyebrow at him.
I have $12 in my purse.
I'll get this.
He smiled at me.
Thank you so much, Sheriff. I'll pay you back.
No problem.
He inclined his head toward Katrina again.
Do you mind giving me a ride back to the hotel, dear?
Before she responded to the Count, she glanced at Conrad.
My hotel?
I'm embarrassed to say, but I really don't have anywhere else to stay.
Rolling her eyes, she stood and petted dog and handed me a business card. Here's my contact information.
Do you have one?
I sighed. I think I do, in a drawer at my office somewhere.
Well, if we hear anything, I'm sure we'll be able to track you down.
I'm sure. Shaking hands with the Count, I watched them exit out the front onto Sheridan Avenue and walk toward the corner. Conrad watched the two of them go and then turned to me.
I hope you find who did this, Sheriff.
His grip was sure, and I watched him depart through the front doorway.
Thanks. I do, too.
The bartender arrived with the check. $638.42. No Count. As I turned the corner at the landing at the top of the stairs, I was pretty sure there was a fight going on down the hall and slowed my pace, as it appeared to be coming from our wing. Stopping in the hallway, I listened some more, but the noise had died down. So I drew the magnetic key card from my pocket and started to run it through the device on the lock just as the noise started up again from the room next door. I stood there assuring myself that it wasn't the kind of altercation that needed any interference, and then tripped the lock on our door and followed Dog into the darkened room with the television blaring. Vic sat in the bed, naked, the sheet tucked under both arms with the remote in her hand as Dog jumped up to join her. Carefully placing my wrinkled, rented jacket on the back of a chair, I turned it and sat, taking off my boots.
What are you watching?
The Legend of Custer.
Bad?
Very.
The only person I think I recognize is the guy who wrote the bomb in Dr. Strangelove. Slim Pickens.
Yeah. Anyway, you can't watch anything for the bacchanalia going on next door.
I dropped a boot and pried off the next one, all the while listening to the noise.
How long has that been going on?
Forever.
Well, how nice for them.
How about you go and pound on the door?
I don't really want to do that.
How about I do it?
I don't really want that either.
She flipped off the TV, and I had to admit there was an abundance of animal-like noises emanating through the wall.
Then what?
If you can't fight 'em.
I dropped my second boot with a thunk and smiled at her.
Join 'em.
Jaya Longbow Long was truly impressive in an easy, nonchalant way, dribbling the ball on the outskirts of the game. As she passed it between her legs and then casually spun it on a finger like a rotating planet, I guess her age should be 17, going on 35. There were boys at the Montana girls' basketball 3-on-3 state championship because, well, there were girls. She was tall, like her aunt, Lolo Long, tribal police chief on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, and the boys on the sideline waved to her, but she ignored them and said watching the opponents from the Crow Reservation, she would soon play. The Cheyenne and Crow had been adversaries for thousands of years, and the basketball competition did little to convince anyone that members of the two tribes had ever buried the hatchet except into one another. The girls were ferocious, using their feet to trip and saber-like elbows to crowd their way into the semifinals. The three young women from Lame Deer, representing the Cheyenne, stood by and watched the trio from Hardin as they attempted to put a lid on a Polson team from the Flathead Reservation. Are there any non-Indian girls who play basketball in Montana?
The Cheyenne Nation turned to look at Vic.
Not as well as we do.
Glancing down the bleachers of the outdoor event, I was glad we'd gotten to Billings early. The place was packed. Granted, we were only an hour away from two of the biggest reservations in Montana, so the native presence was very strong, and you got the feeling that there was a lot of tribal pride on the line. There were four half courts on North Broadway when the competition had started, but now that we were only one game away from the championship, the action had centered right in front of us. One of the Crow girls faked a layup and then pivoted and passed the ball to another, who dropped a 10-footer with nothing but net. There was a thunderous cry from the assembled masses, and you knew that the majority of the audience was, indeed, Crow. Jaya Long stood in the other court with the ball tucked under one elbow, as she watched the Crow players congratulate one another, something I hadn't seen the Cheyenne women do after they had beaten the Strong Harden team earlier. They had simply walked off the court and stood together, but not looking at one another, instead watching the other teams the way red-tailed hawks sit on fence posts and watch field mice. Predatory.
They were going to take a 30-minute break so we can go down and you can meet her.
Henry stood, but Vic remained seated.
You're not going?
She shrugged.
I'll save our seats.
I followed the bear, and we squeezed out of the aisle, clanged down the